Welcome to the reading of National Geographic. I'm Susan Tucker for the Virginia Voice, and I'll begin by reading articles from the April 2024 edition of National Geographic magazine. Surprising scenes in stone. Recently completed excavations of a Roman-era synagogue reveal elaborate mosaics and upend long-held beliefs about ancient Jewish life. When archaeologist Jody Magnus climbed the sunny hilltop overlooking the Sea of Galilee in the summer of 2010, she was unsure what she might find there. An ancient Jewish village known as Hukkah once stood on the site in northeastern Israel. But all that remained above ground was a jumble of centuries-old building stones, modern debris, and wild mustard plants. Magnus, a professor of early Judaism at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and a National Geographic explorer, had spent years leading excavations in Israel, suspected that this hilltop was worth exploring. By the following summer, she and her team had discovered a stone wall running north to south, some 7 feet below ground. Several pieces of evidence, including a main doorway oriented toward Jerusalem, revealed that it was the perimeter of a synagogue that had been constructed some 1,600 years ago, in the early 5th century. Similar buildings of that era had floors paved with flagstones. But as the team kept digging, they unearthed more and more small mosaic stones, called tesserae, a hint that something truly special might lie beneath. On a hot day in June 2012, Brian Bozong, a recent graduate of Brigham Young University, was carefully removing dirt from his excavation square when he scraped against something hard at floor level. He alerted Magnus, and as she brushed away the remaining dirt, the two were stunned to see the face of a woman delicately traced in tesserae staring up at them. It was the first section of a mosaic to come to light. Over the next decade, Magnus returned to Hukkah each June with an international team of experts and student volunteers. She had originally planned to spend only 5 seasons excavating part of the site, but quickly realized she was in for a much longer haul. The project goals would now have to include preserving whatever was left of the mosaic floor, and what was left, revealed slowly year after year, turned out to be extraordinary. The outline of the synagogue, when fully exposed, was about 65 feet long by 50 feet wide. The entire expanse of the floor had been covered in expertly rendered mosaic panels, though only about half of what the original floor remained intact. Usually, in an ordinary church or synagogue, you have 1, 2, or 3 scenes presented, but here you have many more, says Gideon Avni, chief archaeologist with the Israel Antiquities Authority, which licensed the excavation. It's probably the best, most diverse concentration of mosaics in the country. Many of the surviving mosaics depict stories from the Hebrew Bible. Pairs of creatures such as camels, donkeys, elephants, and lions heading toward Noah's Ark. The Red Sea engulfing the Egyptian army. Carpenters and masons building the Tower of Babel. Samson carrying the gate of Gaza on his shoulders. There's a lot of violence in these mosaics, a lot of blood and gore, says Magnus, but there's also some humor. Among the most gruesome scenes, a depiction from the Book of Judges, in which a Kenite woman named Jael hammers a tent stake through the head of Canaanite general Sisera. By contrast, a whimsical twist on the story of Jonah portrays the hapless prophet being swallowed by 3 successively larger fish. The mosaics also borrow motifs from classical art, including cupids, theater masks, and the Greek god of the sun, Helios, who rides in his chariot surrounded by the symbols of the zodiac. Hukkah may have been a village in the countryside, But it wasn't isolated, says DIG Assistant Director Dennis Mizzi, Senior Lecturer in Hebrew and Ancient Judaism at the University of Malta. It was connected with the wider Mediterranean world. That means the community was aware of a wide range of traditions and comfortable enough with ideas from outside its own area. While there are still questions about how exactly the synagogue originated, the discovery of its remains is now rewriting history, particularly our understanding of how Jews lived under foreign rule. Romans conquered the land east of the Mediterranean, including Galilee, in the 1st century BC. Initially, they recognized Judaism as an ancestral religion. Jewish people were allowed to live according to their own laws and were granted exemptions, such as not having to worship the emperor. That really doesn't change significantly until Christianity becomes a legal religion in the Roman Empire, and then the empire's official religion, says Magnus. Once that happens in the 4th century, legislation becomes increasingly restrictive of Judaism. New laws sometimes banned the construction of synagogues. If you were going on the basis of that alone, you would think that Jews were persecuted, that they were oppressed, says Magnus, of the people in this region. But at Hukok, the existence of a grand synagogue adorned with bold artistic expressions offers clear evidence that despite tensions, daily life in Galilee may not have been so dismal. Among all the mosaics, one panel is especially dazzling and puzzling. More finely crafted than the rest of the floor, with large sections still intact, it's divided into three horizontal registers. At the bottom, defeated soldiers, a battle elephant, and a bull are dying from bloody spear wounds. In the middle, stone arches shelter men wearing tunics. At the top, two male leaders are meeting, one in a tunic and the other in armor, each accompanied by his followers. Magnus thinks that one in armor is Alexander the Great. His followers are soldiers with battle elephants. He wears the diadem and purple cloak of a king, but is not identified by an inscription. There was only one Greek king in antiquity who was so great that he didn't need a label, Magnus says. That being the case, this mosaic may represent an encounter between the high priest of Jerusalem and Alexander during the famed conqueror's battles against the Persians in the 4th century BC. The story, likely a cherished legend rather than truth, circulated in Jewish communities for centuries. The point of the legend is to show that even Alexander the Great, the greatest of the Greek kings, acknowledged the greatness of the God of Israel, Magnus suggests. This masterpiece, along with the rest of the mosaic panels, was probably laid by specialists from a local family-owned workshop. An inscription by the main door lists several names of people identified as artisans, perhaps the very ones who created the floor. There appear to be brothers within a single family, as well as perhaps a couple of other figures, says Ranan Bustan, a historian of Judaism at Princeton University. A senior artist would have designed the floor and traced out the figures in every panel. Experienced mosaicists fashioned details like faces, hands, and feet, while junior workers filled in backgrounds and the larger fields of color. They worked with stones from the region, cut into long rods on site, and then snipped into tiny cubes. The quality of a mosaic depends on the size of the tesserae. The smaller they're cut, the more details they create. Mosaic specialists measure the number of tesserae per square decimeter, about 15 square inches. In some places at Hukok, the count is as low as 175. In others, it's around 230. But the mysterious three-tiered mosaic comes in at about 500. The density readings in that area approximate what you would find in Constantinople in imperial mosaics, says Karen Britt, a mosaic specialist in Northwest Missouri State University. But that's not the only ostentatious part of the building. Judging from recovered flecks of colorful plaster, portions of the interior may have been brightly painted, inspiring DIG members to dub it the Disco Synagogue. Magnus herself calls it the kitschiest synagogue ever. Parts of the building's interior were probably painted red, white, pink, and yellow, a theme that may have extended to the exterior. Throughout the excavation, Magnus and her team revealed the mosaics in sections, exposing different areas to be cataloged and photographed before covering them back up to protect them in place. After taking into account other finds in the region, Magnus now believes that Hakak Over the Top's design may be evidence of inter-Jewish competition. All the villages in the area are building synagogues, and they're all pretty spectacular, she says. But here, people decided that they were going to build the mother of all synagogues. Likely 2 stories tall and situated at a high point in the village, it must have been visible for a great distance. Such a lavish structure did not come cheap. Perhaps wealthy patrons underwrote the cost, but more likely villagers of lesser means may have been making enough money to donate to a construction fund. At least in the 5th century, Jews in this remote part of the empire seem to have been prospering, but they may have had concerns about how long their religious freedom might last, and they appear to have expressed those concerns on the floor of their synagogue. I think they are grappling with the reality that they are in a rapidly Christianizing world, says mosaic specialist Britt. One way of doing that is to say, look, this is not all that different from periods in the past when Israelites had to deal with other foreign powers, whether it's the Philistines, the Canaanites, the Babylonians, the Greek, the Romans, and now Christian Romans. Boustin, the historian of Judaism, agrees, adding that the theme of God's deliverance through human warriors in the face of foreign domination is something that comes across very strongly. And yet, some generations after it was built, the synagogue was mysteriously abandoned. Given the region's long history of catastrophic seismic activity, it's not hard to imagine an earthquake leaving the synagogue so damaged that it was thought to be unsafe, even though it continued to stand. Eventually, parts of the building collapsed, destroying sections of the mosaics. Another tremor may have delivered the final blow. It wasn't burned, it wasn't taken apart, says Martin Wells, the project's architecture specialist from Austin College in Texas. My guess is an earthquake. In any case, some 800 years after the synagogue was constructed, the region came to be ruled by the Mamluks, a Muslim dynasty based in Egypt. A Mamluk road, part of a network connecting Cairo and Damascus, ran right by the village and brought a flow of merchants and pilgrims. As the area became prosperous once again, the Jewish people who remained repaired the 5th century synagogue while also expanding it and adding a thick concrete-like base, which fortunately protected the mosaics. Beginning in the 15th century, commercial traffic in the area slowed. The synagogue appears to have been abandoned again, and it gradually tumbled to the ground. So it remained until the archaeologist arrived. 12 years after they first started digging, Magnus and her team completed their fieldwork in the summer of 2023. The site remains backfilled to protect the mosaics and has been turned over to the Israel Antiquities Authority and the Jewish National Fund to develop plans for tourism. IAA archaeologist Avni predicts this jewel in the crown of Israel's cultural heritage will become one of its greatest attractions. The digging may be done, but there's much excavated material now in storage in Jerusalem to be analyzed, and many mysteries remain to be solved, Magnus says. My team and I will be coming back for years. Fashion's Desert Graveyard. Clothing from many of the world's favorite brands lies in discarded heaps in Chile's Atacama Desert. How it got there tells the story of modern fast fashion. The Atacama Desert in northern Chile stretches from the Pacific to the Andes across a barren expanse of red-orange rock canyons and peaks. As one of the driest deserts on Earth, it's a bucket list destination for stargazing tourists who come for some of the clearest views of the night sky. With its arid, rocky landscape so closely resembling Mars, the desert has even attracted the attention of NASA, which has tested rovers there. But the Atacama has also attained a less wondrous distinction as one of the world's fast-growing dumps of discarded clothes, thanks to the rapid mass production of inexpensive attire known as fast fashion. The phenomenon has created so much waste that the UN calls it an environmental and social emergency. The challenge is turning off that tap. The numbers tell the tale. Between 2000 and 2014, clothing production doubled, and consumers began buying 60% more clothes and wearing them for half as long as they once did. 3/5 of all clothing is estimated to end up in landfills or incinerators within a year of production. That can translate to a truckload of used clothing dumped or burned every second. Most of the facilities are in South Asia or Africa, where the nations receiving those loads cannot handle the amount. A landfill near Accra, Ghana's capital, that is said to be 60% clothes and 65 feet high has gained international notoriety as a symbol of the crisis. The scene in northern Chile has been dubbed in one online video the greatest fashion garbage patch, a terrestrial variation of the better-known Great Pacific Garbage Patch. Colossal piles of discarded clothes with labels from all over the world stretch as far as the eye can see on the outskirts of Alto Hospicio, a hardscrabble city of 120,000 residents. In one ravine, a pile of jeans and suit jackets, bleached by the harsh sun, rises above a mound of fake fur coats and dress shirts, some still bearing price tags. Bottles, bags, and other trash are mixed in. As images of the clothing heaps spread on the internet, many Chileans express surprise. "I was shocked to think that we were becoming the textile dump for developed countries," says Franklin Zepeda, a director of a company that focuses on circular economic practices. But the story of how the South American nation came to be a repository for the world's apparel rejects has as much to do with globalization and trade as it does with fleeting style trends. At first glance, it might seem that an isolated desert nearly 1,000 miles from Chile's population centers would be an unlikely destination for fast fashion's discards. But the country is also home to one of South America's largest duty-free ports. Located in the coastal city of Iquique on the Atacama's western edge, millions of tons of clothes arrive annually from Europe, Asia, and the Americas. Last year's tally was 46 million tons, according to Chilean customs statistics. Duty-free ports encourage economic activity, as goods are imported and often re-exported without the usual taxes and fees. The duty-free port was established in Iquique in 1975 to help generate jobs and improve an ailing local economy. Chile became one of the world's largest importers of used clothes, which transformed Iquique. As fast fashion exploded, so did imports. The Free Zone was a true revolution for the city's residents, says Bernardo Guerrero, a sociologist at Fundación Crear, an organization that studies Iquique's history and culture. "They suddenly had access to things they could never have imagined, like their own car. apparel began washing in and out of Akiki like waves of global fashions as waves of global fashion changed. Guerrero recalls the time in the 1990s when almost everyone in the city wore the same style of puffer jacket after large shipments of them arrived. It was a sign of what was to come. About 2,000 businesses of all types now operate in the duty-free zone. More than half are foreign. Hand-painted brand logos adorn warehouse doorways and stacks of used cars, another major import, tower over the narrow streets. The free zone has also developed into a sorting depot for textile waste. In essence, we are just recycling the world's clothes, says Mehmet Yildiz, who arrived in Chile from his native Turkey 2 decades ago and operates a clothing import business named Dilara. Yildiz brings in clothes from the United States and Europe, most of them from thrift stores such as Goodwill. Once the garments reach Iquique, workers separate them into 4 categories, ranging from premium to poor quality. Yildiz then exports the best to the Dominican Republic, Panama, Asia, Africa, and even back to the U.S. for resale. Clothing that the importers don't want ends up in hands of truck drivers who ferry it a few miles to the dump outside Alto Hospicio, where it goes through another cycle of resorting and resale in small shops and street markets or at a huge open-air market called La Quebradilla. There, a roaring used clothes trade continues on a half-mile-long strip of some 7,000 stalls. A recent visit turned up faded T-shirts commemorating the 2001 U.S. Open Golf Tournament, a jacket emblazoned with the logo of a Texas police force, and a wool hat with the badge of a California university, among a sea of other cast-offs. Clothing that doesn't sell at the market is destined for the desert, and much of it is made from synthetic materials that won't biodegrade. Scavengers salvage what goods they can. On a cool afternoon, a woman named Genesis rummaged through a pile of formal clothes, nurses' uniforms, underwear, and Crocs, taking fleeces and blankets for the cold nights and earmarking the better garments to sell at the open-air market, where they may fetch a handful of coins. "Everything is useful to me," she said brightly, laughing as she imagined herself in a brand-new summer dress printed with strawberries. "We're lucky to have found this." As helpful as resale markets might have been in the earlier era, they've been overwhelmed by the sheer scale of the mounting discards. New efforts, large and small, are underway to deal with clothing waste, and attention to the mess in the desert may inspire additional projects. In 2018, Franklin Zepeda founded a startup that manufactures building insulation panels from textile waste. "I was motivated by the idea that there was a vast quantity of waste that could perfectly be transformed into raw materials to make new products, reducing the amount of clothes in our desert," he says. Another startup, ExoCytex, based in Santiago, makes yarn from discarded clothes. "Our mission is to eliminate textile waste from Chile," says Rosaria Hevia, ExoCytex owner. "It made me so angry that there wasn't a solution, so I've thrown myself into solving it." Meanwhile, in Iquique, the clothing importer Dilari plans to open a recycling plant this year to make fillings for couch cushions from used clothes. These are small but crucial steps. The most promising solution, one that can handle the problem scales, lies in the hands of the Chilean government. The World Bank forecasts 3.4 billion tons of garbage will be created every year by 2050. As it piles up, many countries are requiring manufacturers to take responsibility for their products at the end of those products' lives. Policies known as extended producer responsibility have been adopted in India, Australia, Japan, Canada, and some U.S. states. In 2016, Chile passed a version into law calling it Extended Liability of the Producer, or LAY REP for short. The law makes producers and importers accountable for six categories of waste: lubricant oils, electronics, batteries, small batteries, containers, and packaging and tires. Initially, textiles were not listed. Tomas Saig, who heads the Chilean Environmental Ministry's Circular Economy Office, says a team is working to add three more product types to the LAY REP, including textiles. The most important thing is to turn off the tap, so to speak, so that these clothes don't keep ending up in the desert, he says. Converting Chile from junkyard into a recycling hub would be a dream. In the meantime, must-have trends blink in and out of fashion, online sales keep churning, and mountains of forgotten clothes continue to grow amid the red sands of Atacama Desert. From the archives, evolving beasts. Staying on the edge of dinosaur discoveries means the view is always changing. With a fourth Jurassic World movie in the works, our fascination with dinosaurs shows no signs of slowing, especially for series superstars Tyrannosaurus Rex and other theropods. Ever since these beasts were first unearthed more than a century ago, National Geographic has been reporting on them, pairing the latest science with vivid illustrations. With every new discovery, our depictions must evolve. Starting in 1919, a magazine feature laid the foundation, describing an Albertosaurus as a powerful flesh eater that was capable of destroying any of its herb-eating relatives. 23 years later, battling T-Rexes appeared in our pages, standing some 20 feet in height. 3.5 decades after that, a 1978 cover story reported that T-Rex was even larger, 50 feet and 6 tons of bad news. Until the late 1990s, most dinosaurs were shown with scaly reptilian skin, but theropod skeletons found in China suggested young T-Rexes had feathers. That led to another new conclusion. We can now say that birds are theropods, just as confidently as we say humans are mammals. And theropods may not have been the unstoppable killers of human fantasy. Discoveries in 2003 revealed that they were selective in their violence and submissive at times. In 2020, we reported that paleontology was in the midst of another revolution, one fueled by a wealth of fresh fossils and innovative research techniques. Even the latest renditions won't necessarily be definitive, but will be steps towards a clearer path of these marvels from the past. And that's all the time we have this week for the reading of articles from National Geographic. I'm Susan Tucker for the Virginia Voice.